calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a whole slew of new rulings coming out of the Supreme Court. Internet file sharing services will be held responsible if they intend for their customers. This is from the Associated Press. To use software primarily to swap songs and movies illegally. Interesting. They rejected warnings that, you know, if you rule this way, things like the iPod are toast. In fact, it was a unanimous decision, sent it back down to a lower court, which had ruled in favor of file sharing services Grokster Limited and Streamcast Networks, Inc., on the grounds that the companies couldn't be sued. Justice said there wasn't enough evidence of unlawful intent for the case to go to trial. So it's interesting. It appears that what they're saying is that if you can, in other words, Grokster and Streamcast had won this case and it went back to the court, but now there may be a different basis for the lawsuit. If I'm reading this right, I mean this is all just like an hour old, right? So but it appears that what they're saying is you have to have some evidence of unlawful intent, that the people putting together the file sharing service have to have some intent that people will use it unlawfully. Now, this is really interesting. I mean, let's expand this. If somebody goes to the bank and takes out $1,000 and then goes down to the local gun show and buys a bunch of weapons and then goes and blows up a school, you know, goes in and shoots a bunch of people and does a Klebold Harris thing, you know, is the bank responsible? Because they supplied the cash. Let's say that they borrowed the money from the bank. Would the bank be responsible? Well, okay, so then the standard then under the Supreme Court case would be, well, yes, they would be if they knew that the cash was going to be used for an illegal purpose. Now, I suppose that there's actually, you know, that is grounded in a long history of Supreme Court cases, or not just Supreme Court cases, of law that says that if you know that somebody's committing a crime, then and you don't do anything about it, then that's a crime. Then you're a co-participant. So really, in a way, this, you know, depending on, again, it's going to depend on how tightly this is parsed. In a way, this may or may not be a big deal for ruling. At issue is whether the file sharing services should be liable, even if they have no direct control over what millions of online users are doing with the software they provide for free. As much as 90% of songs and movies copied on the file sharing networks are downloaded illegally, according to music industry filings. You know, for example, I remember there was a bank of payphones at the corner of 42nd Street and 8th Avenue back in the 70s. And I used to get off at there's a subway stop right there. It's across the street from the bus station. And we had a client that was down on 43rd Street. If I got off there, there were always people there who would, you know, you walk by and they'd offer you drugs. This was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And they were using these payphones, and they were always hanging out near the payphones, and they're using the payphones to do drug deals. Now, if the phone company knows, and it was no secret, I mean, it had to be known. If the phone company knew that those payphones were being used principally for drug deals, should the phone company be shut down? To what extent should they be shut down? It's an interesting one. Judge Souter wrote for the court. He said, "We hold that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyright, that is, to violate a law, as shown by the clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement, is liable for the resulting acts of infringement by third parties." So it seems to me that what they're doing is they're putting a fairly high bar of proving intent here in this case. I mean, we'll see. But it two lower cases had previously sided with Grokster without holding a trial. They both based their decisions, this from the AP, on the 1984 Supreme Court ruling that Sony Corp could not be sued over consumers who used its VCR to make illegal copies of movies. You recall that? The movie industry tried to stop the VCR industry when they first started out and went after Betamax. And in 1984, the Supreme Court ruled that Sony Corp was not responsible, even though VCRs could be used to make illegal copies of movies. And the main reason that they said that was they said that there were substantial legal purposes that the VCR could be used for. Now, if Sony had come out with a VCR that had two slots in it, and the instructions said, put the original movie in the top slot, push this button, and the bottom movie will be a duplicate, then the Supreme Court probably would have ruled against them. But as it was, you know, you could make home movies, you could play movies, you could watch movies, you could record TV shows, you could do all kinds of things that were legal, that fit under the fair use doctrine. I think the fair use doctrine is still going to come into place in here. I don't think that this is going to be a huge big deal, frankly. So, you know, time will tell. But I don't think that particular case. The case, another one of the cases that the Supreme Court came out with, and I don't have the details on this. I'll get them during the next break. But I just caught this in the news as we were doing our local show here in Portland. The Supreme Court ruled that companies that provide internet services over the cable, that is, cable companies that have cable services into your home, can prevent secondary companies from using that same copper to provide competing cable services, or competing internet services. And it's going to be interesting to see why that and why not telephones. And then the Ten Commandments. This is perhaps one of the most interesting. The court issued two rulings on the Ten Commandments. The first said that a Ten Commandments display inside a courtroom is a violation of the law. Inside courthouses. This is. Some people say this is mixed signals. I don't think so. I think it's pretty clear. The High Court said that displays of the Ten Commandments are not inherently unconstitutional. Right? If it's just a display of the Ten Commandments, that's not inherently unconstitutional. For example, in the Supreme Court building, there's an artistic display of the Ten Commandments, along with hundreds of other things. But if the monument of the Ten Commandments, or if the Ten Commandments is pretty conspicuously, hey, here's the law kind of thing, then it is a violation. So in one case, and Sandra Day O'Connor was a swing vote in this, in one case they said you can't have it. This was in Kentucky. Framed copies of the Ten Commandments in two Kentucky courthouses went too far in endorsing religion, the court held. These courthouse displays are unconstitutional, the justice said, because their religious content is overemphasized. On the other hand, on the state grounds of Texas, the Texas Capitol, Texas State House, there are, on this 22-acre lot, there are 17 historical displays. The history of Texas, remember the Alamo, you know, when we became a state, all this kind of stuff. And one of them is the Ten Commandments. And Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote for the majority in that case, saying, of course the Ten Commandments are religious, they were viewed so at their inception and so remain. The monument, therefore, has religious significance. But simply having religious content or promoting a message consistent with the religious doctrine does not run afoul of the Establishment Clause. In other words, you can have something that is religious, and it can even be on public property. But if it's not openly promoting a particular religion, particularly in a courthouse, then you don't have so much of a problem. And it's going to be interesting to read this decision, too, and find out to what extent the courthouse thing. Because, you know, what's this going to do? Is this going to then, are we back to the argument about whether or not Christmas trees, for example, or menorahs can or cannot be displayed in public schools? You know, I would suggest that in all probability that a Christmas display in a public school would be seen as promoting a religion. On the other hand, if you had in a classroom a whole bunch of different icons of different religious symbols. If you had a cross and a Star of David and a menorah and the crescent of the Islamic crescent and a Buddha, an image of a Buddha, and maybe Ganesh, you know, here we are back to the Tulsa Zoo, right? And something like that, then that probably wouldn't run afoul of this. So with these two decisions, it appears, and again, these are just a couple of hours old, so this is my initial take on this. But it appears that in these two decisions that the court is saying, you know, it's okay to acknowledge religion, it's not okay to promote religion on the part of the state. The state-run institutions, state-run buildings, and particularly courthouses, but maybe not particularly courthouses. Again, we're going to have to read the actual ruling. But there is a doctrine of separation of church and state. They confirmed that. That's the really good news. I think this is probably, my take on this is that these are both very rational decisions. That they're saying there is a doctrine of separation of church and state. That the state should not be in the business of promoting religion. That if the state does that, that is a violation of the First Amendment. And although they didn't say it, I mean, you know, the flip side of that, of course, is if churches promote politics or promote a state, and, well, actually, churches aren't barred from doing that. This is the interesting thing. The Constitution, all they do is they lose their tax-exempt status, which is not a penalty. It's the failure to have a reward. A very important distinction. The Constitution does not grant us rights. This is the thing that, you know, so many people don't understand. But it's just, you know, it's right there. The Constitution does not grant us rights. The Constitution limits the powers, by and large. The Constitution limits the powers of government. And so, you know, limiting the government from promoting states, from promoting state religion or from promoting religion in general, that's viewed as a good thing by the founders. That was viewed as a good thing by the founders. On the other hand, if a church wants to be politically active, they can certainly be politically active. Churches have always been able to be politically active. It's just that if they get too politically active, then they can no longer say, hey, you guys have to pay for our infrastructure, and we don't have to pay taxes. So they lose a benefit. They're not punished. They lose a benefit. This is, you know, in the church and state area, this is one of the things that it really concerns me how few Americans understand this, that nobody is saying, the Supreme Court, nobody else is saying churches can't be political. We're simply saying, hey, if you don't want to pay taxes, if you want to use the police services, you want to use the fire department, you want to use the public roads to have people get to your church, you want to use the telephones and the internet and all that stuff, you want to use all that stuff that we're all paying for, and you don't want to pay taxes, don't get involved in politics. If you want to get involved in politics, fine, start paying taxes. I'm Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The Supreme Court just rolling along. The eminent domain decision, it was amazing. Over the weekend, we were in Michigan over the weekend, and we did the remote on Friday from WTKG in Grand Rapids, and on Saturday I went to my brother's son's wedding, my nephew's wedding, or wedding reception, actually. I missed the wedding itself. I gave a speech Saturday afternoon down at Olivet College. And Sunday, of course, we flew home and back here to Portland, Oregon. And I had rented, we showed up at the car rental place, and the rental car we were given had satellite radio in it. And I thought, well, what the heck, let's listen to right-wing talk radio all weekend. So that's what Louise and I subjected ourselves to, right-wing. I had no idea how bad some of it is, how just incredibly pathetic it is. It was mind-boggling. I mean, it was Michael Reagan. I was listening to this. I'm going, who's this guy with the speech impediment? You know, he's going on, and I don't even mean about how he talks. It's like he's saying, You know, the Constitution says life, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He says, you know, they really meant life, liberty, and private property. And I'm like, wait a minute, Michael. Life, liberty, and private property is a phrase from John Locke, from his second treatise on government, 1724. And, yeah, Jefferson borrowed the life and liberty part of that, but and private property is protected in the Constitution, certainly by the Fifth Amendment, if nothing else. This is what, in my opinion, the Supreme Court took a meat axe to. But over the weekend, spending some time with this decision, it becomes pretty clear that what the court did was they ratified something that's been going on for a long, long time. And perhaps the most egregious example of that something that's been going on for a long, long time is what George W. Bush did. I mean, Bush and his press secretary, you know, are running around saying, George Bush is all Scotty McClellan. George Bush is in favor of private property rights. He's always been in favor of private property rights. Yeah, right. George Bush borrowed $605,000 and bought a little more than 1% stake in the Texas Rangers. Right, 1.8% share in the club. With money, somebody loaned it to him. Yeah, it's a good. And then when he sold it to Tom Hicks, you know, one of the owners of Clear Channel, I believe, for between $10 and $14 million. It's a 23-time investment on George Bush's return in 9 years. What made his investment in the Rangers worth so much more? They were able to convince the city of Arlington, Texas, to use eminent domain to take property from people and build a stadium at an expense to the city of $135 million. Now, one of the families that they went in and they said, we're going to bulldoze your house and take your property, one of these families said, no, we don't want to go. We really don't want to go. We don't want to sell you this property. And the city said, tough, you know, we're using eminent domain. This is the Mathis family. And so they sued. The Mathis family sued. I mean, they took their property anyway, right, with eminent domain. In other words, they did for George Bush and his business buddies what the Supreme Court ruled just last Friday. They did it in Arlington, Texas. And George Bush made a $14 million profit as a result of it. A 23-fold increase in his return on investment. He's able to pay back the original loan. Now, Bush is coming out and saying he's against this Supreme Court decision. You got Scotty McClellan saying, you got all the bloviators in the right wing saying, hey, wait a minute, this is those liberals. They want to take away your property. Excuse me, this is how George Bush became a millionaire. I mean, he was setting aside the fact that he was born into with a trust fund worth millions, but this is how he made his first million on his own, was taking money that he had borrowed from a family friend, putting it into a sweetheart deal, And then having the city of Arlington take money away from this family. The story actually even gets stranger than that. We'll get back to that and lots more right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Scott Forrester, engineering our program. Good morning, Scott. And Louise producing. Another court case that came down. This may actually, you know, when you be even larger than some of the others, when you aggregate all these things, it seems to me that what we're seeing is creeping fascism in the United States. The loss of liberty and the loss of our institutions and the loss of competition, the loss of the opportunity for the little guy, that being in the broadband case, in the cable case. But here, the United States Supreme Court, Adam Liptek wrote this for the New York Times. The United States Supreme Court declined today to hear the cases of two reporters facing jail time for refusing to testify about their conversations with their confidential sources. This is Judith Miller and Matt what's Matt's last name? I was going to say Hogan, but that's the prosecutor. Matt Cooper. Hogan is the judge. Matt Cooper of Time Magazine and Judith Miller of the New York Times. Now, you know, I have a few problems with Judith Miller of the New York Times. She was the one who was listening to Ahmed Chalabi and kept writing all these, oh, we've got to go to war. Oh, the weapons of mass destruction, they're there. They're going to get us. Articles in the New York Times back before we went to war with Iraq. She was using the New York Times. She was used to use, you know, by this administration and Ahmed Chalabi and others whose interests were really more on the side of the Iranians than and Chalabi, of course, on the side of himself, you know, of wealth and power, to get an invasion of Iraq. I mean, and the oil companies, they wanted the oil. And more than anything else, of course, George W. Bush wanted the political capital, right? But in any case, I still don't wish her prison. And she's now looking at 18 months in jail, as is Matt Cooper, because the Supreme Court said it's not going to hear the case. Should reporters be able to keep their sources confidential? I think so, absolutely. In fact, you had 34 prosecuting attorneys testify on behalf, or state's attorney general, excuse me, the attorneys general of 34 states submitted an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, with the Supreme Court. In other words, on behalf of Miller and Cooper, saying that they didn't think that these two should be prosecuted. We have 49 states out of the 50 states in the United States that have state laws that protect the constitutionality of, or protect the privacy of sources that say, you know, if you have a source, that source can be confidential, the confidentiality of sources. And yet the Supreme Court says, nah, we're not going to hear the case. Let him go to jail. The judge's ruling stands in this case. Judge Hogan. And so the New York Times, of course, saying that they are disappointed. Extremely disappointed, says Judith Miller. I'm extremely disappointed. Journalists simply cannot do their job without being able to commit to sources that they won't be identified. Such protection is critical to the free flow of information in a democracy. I agree. And in my opinion, this is the passing of a law. Actually, the laws have been passed. This is the application of a law that limits freedom of the press. And the First Amendment of the Constitution is unambiguous about it. It doesn't say the freedom of the press shall not be abridged unless it's to disclose the source of a journalist. No, it says the freedom of the press shall not be abridged. Period. End of sentence. Well, it's not literally the end of sentence because there's other freedoms that are protected in the First Amendment in that sentence. But end of point. Right? It's just very clear. So we have the Supreme Court saying, okay, corporations can collude with cities to take property, big corporations. We have the Supreme Court saying government can punish media that it doesn't like. They can go after the press if the, you know, individual reporters, if those reporters outsources in a way that the government doesn't like, as we have here, as we certainly have here. This is of course about the case. And that I know the Bush administration doesn't, would just assume it wasn't discussed. And unfortunately, it's not discussed more about Joe Wilson's wife being outed because Joe Wilson wrote a New York Times op-ed talking about how George Bush was lying to us about the uranium. Here's Joe Wilson.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
You know, talking about that very case about the outing of the CIA agent, Joe Wilson convinced that Karl Rove played some role in it. And a lot of the speculation now centers on Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney, that Dick Cheney may be the guy who committed the felony, or maybe it was Cheney and Bush together. Cheney and Rove together. And, of course, George W. Bush's famous comment on it, lest we forget.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
No, I don't have any idea. Well, odds are he did have an idea, and he could have solved the crime. Now, the prosecutor in this case is Patrick Fitzgerald. special prosecutor, has already said that way back in October he had wrapped up the case. He knows who did it. But he really wanted the testimony of either Miller or Cooper so that he would have a corroborating witness. You know, he'd have corroborative testimony so that he'd have a slam dunk case. He could actually put somebody in jail. Or maybe he just wanted to string the thing out long enough for Bush to go through another election cycle without embarrassment. After all, that was October. The elections were in November. If in October Patrick Fitzgerald had announced that he was going to be prosecuting Karl Rove or Dick Cheney or Dick Cheney's assistant Scooter Libby or even George W. Bush for violating federal law and outing a CIA agent, then the odds are that might have had some influence on the election. So anyhow, they took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, nope, not going to hear the case, which leaves standing Judge Hogan's ruling. Now, this is the argument here is that reporters are not above the law, that if a reporter knows of a crime, that they have an obligation to report it just like everybody else does. And this goes back to a lot of laws that were passed in the 60s and 70s, particularly in the 70s, and as part of the anti-Vietnam War hysteria. Uh-oh, we've got to find the traitors among us, although some of them go back to the 40s and 50s, the anti-communism hysteria that made it a crime to not report a crime if you knew about it, and the Supreme Court has ruled on this as well. And so they're saying, okay, there's no special exemption. There used to be all these special exemptions. Used to be that if you were a priest and somebody came to you and confessed that a crime, that you could say, okay, do 35 Hail Marys, and that's that. Now, there are some crimes, particularly sexual offenses against minors, that if you tell a priest about, the priest has to call the police. Somebody goes to a priest and confesses that they have molested or have been molested, the priest, by law, is required now to call the police. And so, you know, these protections have been broken down for the priests. Similarly for psychotherapists and psychologists. And this is something that the psychology industry is very concerned about. And social workers and school counselors. Now, arguably, you know, you say with a school counselor, arguably, they really should report things. But on the other hand, you again, it's not so much should it be reported or not. It's should the person who's receiving the information have the discretion of choosing whether or not to report it. Because what you have now is a situation where many people who actually could seek and get help 20 years ago, 30 years ago, for these kinds of problems or crimes, for that matter, seek and get help so that they don't commit more crimes, are now afraid to seek and get that help, and thus they become, you know, chronic criminals and that, you know, and on and go. I mean, that's the downside of it. So, but there used to be these protections carved out. The priests, the psychotherapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, school counselors, there used to be these protections carved out, and doctors, physicians, and lawyers still have some confidentiality. Of course, almost all of our legislators are lawyers. That may have something to do with it. And one of the protections that used to be carved out was for journalists. The journalists could take private information, secret information, and decide to use it or not. It was up to them. And they would protect their sources, and they would defend their sources. And journalists have been defending their sources since the founding of this country. And it just really concerns me. I just have this creepy feeling that what we are seeing is incremental fascism here in the United States. The erosion of the right of reporters to out government officials for doing wrong. The power of government to take away private property and claim that they're doing it for the greater good. And I realize that the conservatives agree with me on this. That doesn't make it right or wrong. I mean, there are some things that are simply right, in my opinion. And you know, my commitment is to truth, not to partisanship. And although, interestingly, the conservatives are spinning this. The conservatives are taking, for example, the eminent domain case from last week and saying, see, it's those liberals on the court who want to get you. No, I'm sorry. There's no liberals on this court. There are extreme right-wing cranks like Scalia and Rehnquist and Thomas. Scalia and Thomas in particular. They are right-wing extremists in the mold of Mussolini. I mean, they are right-wing extremists. And then you've got some folks who are just kind of old guard Republicans, which is pretty much everybody else. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe you could say that in some areas she's a little liberal. But come on, we don't have liberals on this court. Not classic liberals. Yeah, we've got at the very worst moderate. So anyhow, that's a summary of what's happened today. Let's get your thoughts on it. Our number 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Marvin in Melvin, Texas on the line. Hey, Marvin, what's up?
Comment on the fact of who they chose to prosecute and who they ignored. It seems to me like the two reporters are going to jail for not reporting a name that the government wanted reported.
That's correct. That's correct. And you know, apparently what's really bizarre is they never published the story. Right. So they didn't publish the story. And you've got Jeff Gannon going around saying that he had the information as well, and nobody's tried to prosecute him. So but the guy who actually published the story, you know, Robert Novak of Crossfire fame and John Stewart, I think, calls him scumbag for liberty, Robert Novak. Robert Novak is not being prosecuted. Apparently, Robert Novak has turned in his sources. I'm not sure, but apparently he has. Bonnie in Cincinnati, Ohio, on the line. Hey, Bonnie. Bonnie, you got to listen to your telephone, not the radio. Okay, I'm going to put Bonnie on hold, and we will move on to Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, Rick.
Hello.
Hey, apparently Scott is typing things into the wrong lines here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great.
A little delay there.
Okay. Yeah. There's a delay on the telephone. Is this Rick in Grand Rapids?
Yes.
Okay. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I just want to go back to the point here. A couple of things. I'm not quite clear from what you're saying how the Supreme Court ruled in this confidential case. Or reporters divulging their source, they just wouldn't take the case. Was that it?
Yeah, they didn't take the case. And so what it did was it bounced back down to the lower court where Judge Thomas F. Hogan had said, if they don't tell, then they go to jail for 18 months or until Patrick Fitzgerald puts his case forward, whichever is sooner. And Fitzgerald has already said that last October he'd wrapped up his case, but he wanted their testimony. So Fitzgerald says he won't bring the case forward until they testify, and they never testify, then there will never be any prosecution of this.
And is it your feeling they shouldn't have to testify?
Yes.
But then how are we going to find out who in the White House divulged this information?
Well, our hope, well, first of all, Patrick Fitzgerald already has enough information, apparently, to begin prosecution. He just wants a little bit more. But even if these guys were the only ones who knew, in my opinion, it is more important for anybody who might want to blow the whistle to a reporter to know that if that reporter says, I will keep your name confidential, that they will, that they can't be compelled by a court to give up that name. I think that that's a more important thing for democracy than nailing Karl Rove.
Well, I'll tell you
as much as I would love to see Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House.
Okay, but I guess I disagree for two reasons. Number one, I don't care whether it's Rove or anybody else, and I don't care whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration, and I'm not a real big fan of the CIA, but if you divulge a CIA agent's identity, I think that's about as close to treason as anything can be. And secondly,
according to George Bush Sr., it is treason.
Exactly. But secondly, Tom, the key point here is not to protect the identity of whistleblowers. It is to protect whistleblowers so they won't have to be unanimous, correct?
Well, that's a whole different set of laws, Rick. That's a completely different thing. And it may not be even whistleblowers. I mean, you know, reporters have to have confidentiality rights, period. That's why 49 states have passed these laws.
Why do you think so, though?
Because without it, you can't have a free press. The First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law infringing the rights of a free press. And you can't have a free press. The press is not free to do its job if they can't guarantee to somebody who wants to give them information in secret that person's name is going to remain secret, who gave them the information.
But has this always been the case, even before the national security state we now have?
Absolutely. It's why Woodward and Bernstein never went to jail.
No, but what I'm saying is prior to 1947, when we had the CIA and all of this, national security and the Red Scare and all that, has it always been the case historically that newspapers and anybody who wants to publish anything has always said the government cannot prevent us from having confidential sources, even if, like you said, you know, you use the analogy of someone reporting a crime or confessing a crime to a priest. I guess to me, a crime being committed and somebody knowing it and not reporting it for some technicality like that. I just think that's terrible.
Well, I agree that it's terrible, Rick, but here's where it comes down. Always you have to make the decision. Which is more important, democracy or this particular situation? It's like in the Miranda case, you know, do we let this guy walk because he wasn't Mirandized? And I believe that democracy is more important, frankly, preserving democracy, which only happens with a free press, is more important than prosecuting Karl Rove. And that's the bottom line for me on this. I'll explain a little more after this. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now you don't.
We're taking a country back. Son, you ain't been doing it right. I don't like how you've been treating our stars and stripes, yeah. You say unite, but you divide us more. So we're taking our country back. Oh, welcome back, my friends. Time to take back our country. Yes, indeed. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, John in Dallas on the line. Hey, John, you disagree with me?
Tom, you know, in most things, 95% I'm with you all the way, buddy. But in this case, I think that if you were talking about news people 40 years ago, 45 years ago, I probably would agree with you again. However, most of the people today, to sell sensationalism and articles and, hey, I got proof at this, but I can't give up my source, hinders the prosecution, hinders the constitutional, very thing you think you're trying to protect. It actually hinders the constitutionality of a man who may have done something against our Constitution, and we can't even find out who the hell it is. So,
well,
in this case, I happen to disagree, but lightly, okay?
Okay.
I really think, quite frankly, news people today want to sell newspapers, want to sell their jobs, want to sell this, want to sell that, and they're not supporting us in any shape, form, or fashion.
Yeah, John, I don't altogether disagree with you, but I have to say there are some real journalists out there, and they are still, and journalism still does exist. And if we want journalism to survive, we have to draw a circle around it or a box around it or whatever. We have to circumscribe it and say, hey, this is to be protected. And the founders understood that clearly, and that's why the First Amendment of the Constitution says Congress shall pass no laws limiting freedom of the press. And anything that limits freedom of the press and saying, hey, if somebody talks to you, you've got to tell us about it, and if you don't, you go to jail. That's limiting freedom of the press, in my opinion. And I tell you, I am at the front of the line. If there was a line of people who want to see, you know, Karl Rove frog marched off to jail, like Joe Wilson said, I'd be at the front of that line. But if Karl Rove going free is what it takes to preserve the freedom of the press in the United States, I'll go with freedom of the press, frankly. That's just that's my position. John, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. I'm Tom Hartman.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 1,385 days since 9/11. 1,385 days. Now, how long do you think it took from the time Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese through all of our involvement in World War II to the day that we saw the surrender of Japan? 1,365 days. 1,365 days from Pearl Harbor to the end of World War II. 1,365 days. It has now been 1,385 days since 9/11. Do you know where Osama bin Laden is? That we should, you know, this should become one of those, you know, it's 9 p.m. Do you know where your children are? It's June 27th. Do you know where Osama is? And then on top of this, we've got George Bush and George W. Bush Jr. and Dick Cheney out there running around going, "Oh, those liberals, they just want to provide therapy to the terrorists." Say what? No. Those liberals out there want to catch the terrorists, put them in prison where they can't do any more terrorism, brand them as criminals so everybody will see them for what they are, rather than turning them into war heroes. George W. Bush has done more to advance the cause of worldwide terrorism than any politician in the last two centuries. By his wrong-headed, fumbling dealing with, number one, the response to 9/11, and number two, by attacking a country that had nothing to do with 9/11 and didn't attack us. It's like, as if we had... Can you imagine where we would be right now if the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and Franklin Roosevelt had said, "Oh, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. You know, there's some Japanese living down there in Chile and in Peru. We're going to attack South America." And we went after South America. Well, that's what Bush did. Osama bin Laden, who is a Saudi, who was living in Afghanistan, attacked the United States, and so we go after Iraq? But 50% of Republicans who voted for George W. Bush in the last election will tell you, but there were Iraqis flying those planes into the towers in 9/11. No, there weren't. Not one. They were mostly Saudis. 15 out of the 19 were Saudis. Osama bin Laden was trying to provoke a confrontation between the United States and Saudi Arabia. These were Saudi nationalists. They think that the Saudi royal family is a corrupt institution. And by the way, keep an eye on the Saudi royal family right now. There's something going on, something really serious going on. And in my opinion, that is what is roiling world oil prices, not what's going on in Iran. You see oil over $60 a barrel right now. And I've heard preliminary reports that Prince Bandar has retired himself as you know, influential in the oil business in Saudi Arabia, as oil minister, and that perhaps King Fahd is about to die and there's going to be an incredible power struggle. And maybe we're going to learn that Saudi Arabia doesn't have quite all the oil that we thought they did. Time will tell. But keep an eye on it. I don't think we'll ever see $50 a barrel oil again. We will never see $2 a gallon gasoline again in the United States. But in any case, I got a bit of a digression there. But the whole point of the digression was that Osama bin Laden believed that we were propping up a corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the royal family, and that, you know, the Bush Senior, Bush Junior, the whole bunch of them, at Clinton, that we were propping up a corrupt government in Saudi Arabia, and that government, in exchange for our propping up their corrupt government, they were giving us cheap oil. And on top of that, we had imposed upon them, and during the Gulf War, we placed Prince Bandar Air Force Base or whatever it is. I don't think it was Prince. It's named after one of the princes. The Air Force Base there in Saudi Arabia. We had men who were drinking alcohol and women who were driving cars and voting by mail in the United States, and, you know, heaven forbid, and their heads were not covered, they were not wearing burkas, and, you know, this is intolerable. And Osama bin Laden told us in the early 1990s, if you guys don't, and in 98 he was very outspoken about it, very explicit about it, if you guys don't pull your soldiers out of Saudi Arabia, off the holy ground that you're defiling, and if you don't stop propping up this corrupt government that is selling the treasure of Saudi Arabia, the oil, that should be worth at least $200 a barrel on international markets for $10, $20 a barrel. Keep in mind, when George Bush came into office, oil was selling for $10, $12 a barrel. Or was it, maybe it was 18. I'd have to go back and look. In any case, it was under $20 a barrel. And bin Laden's going, that's wrong. And if you don't change that, he said he was going to attack us, and sure enough, he did. And it was Saudis in those airplanes. Because bin Laden wanted to unite the Wahhabists, this cult within Islam, this right-wing cult within Islam, not that different from the Falwells and the Robertsons, the right wing and the focus and the Dobsons, the right wing cult within Christianity. He wanted the right wing cult within Islam to draw more of mainstream Islam in with it and unite them around the world against us. And George Bush has helped them incredibly. And then you get Karl Rove coming out and saying, oh, the liberals, they just wanted to give therapy and indictments to terrorists. But we knew what to do, he says. We knew what to do. Yeah. So this from the Democratic Underground on the discussion board. It was posted. And it's a hoot. I don't see a name on the posting here. But anyhow, here, hey kids, are you wondering, like Karl Rove was lately, what the difference between liberals and conservatives is? Neither am I, but then you and I are not as stupid as a Republican official. Still, in case you came across an acquaintance or relative who's interested in discussing that difference, here's a handy quiz to help them through the quandary. Notes this contributor to the Democratic Underground bulletin board, which is democraticunderground.com. One, Karl Rove said, conservatives saw the savagery of 9/11 and the attacks and prepared for war. What was the most important part of that preparation? A, sitting motionlessly to listen to schoolchildren read My Pet Goat before sprinting for a bunker in Nebraska to hide for the rest of the day. B, preventing Dixie Chick records from being played on the radio. C, renaming fried potatoes and fried egg dip bread so that France doesn't get credit for them. Or D, making officers who point out what was actually needed for war resign from the Pentagon. Which of those was the most important part of the preparation for war that Karl Rove was talking about? Conservatives saw the savagery of 9/11 prepared for war. What was the second most important part of that preparation? A, trying to get the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge open for drilling because otherwise the terrorists would win. Yes, Republicans actually said that. B, trying to get a massive tax break for the richest 1% of Americans. Otherwise the terrorists would have won. C, letting the guy who masterminded the 9/11 savagery stroll unimpeded into Pakistan. D, destroying evidence in the anthrax attack case. Which of the young conservatives of draft age threw moderation and restraint aside and joined the military immediately? After all, this is what Karl Rove said. Karl Rove told his conservative audience, he said, I don't know about you, but moderation and restraint is not what I felt when I watched the Twin Towers crumble to the ground, a side of the Pentagon destroyed, and almost 3,000 of our fellow citizens perish in flames and rubble. So, which of these following young conservatives threw moderation and restraint aside and joined the military immediately? They're all of military age. Jenna and Barbara Bush, the daughters of the president? There's a lot of women joining the military. Nope. George P. Bush, a nephew of the president. No. Jeb Bush Jr., nephew of the president. No. How about Billy Bush, the cousin of the president? No. Well, how about Karl Rove's son, Andrew Rove? Certainly he threw moderation and restraint aside and joined the military. No. Just Pat Tillman. No relation to anybody in the White House. In fact, his family's a little fried with the White House right now. So which of these were the most valuable results, the most valuable outcome of conservatives not being moderate or restrained? A, because Rove said, we saw 9/11 and we were not moderate and we were not restrained. So which of these outcomes was the most valuable result of that? A, we invaded a country that had nothing to do with 9/11 attacks, and now 135,000 American troops are bogged down in a futile occupation. B, virtually every ally we had in the world is estranged, and this country, which was a beacon of human rights, is now synonymous with torture. C, Osama bin Laden, the architect of 9/11 savagery, remains at large with his criminal organization much larger and more powerful than before the attacks. Or D, our troops are fighting alone, while the White House pretends like countries like Eritrea and the Solomon Islands are helping the war effort. Yeah, those conservatives, they really know how to fight a war, don't they? Karl Rove fretted aloud to his audience about danger to our troops, that liberals might represent a danger to our troops. Which of these actions is least likely to increase this danger? A, claiming that war is a cakewalk and refusing to adequately prepare for the effort needed. Yes, that was a phrase used by one of the neocons testifying before Congress. B, failing to secure weapons depots and ammunition dumps after the invasion. C, equipping the troops with inadequate and antiquated gear and publicly sneering at their concerns. D, keeping battle-weary troops on the front lines indefinitely. Or E, pointing out that the torture currently being inflicted in the GOP's concentration camp in Guantanamo was pretty much like the torture dished out in totalitarian regimes. You're starting to get the sense of this. Rove also talked about the savagery of 9/11. What would have been the drawbacks of offering therapy and understanding to our attackers? A, Osama bin Laden and his gang might have been indicted, captured, tried, and punished due to the cooperation of nearly every law enforcement agency on the planet. B, Al-Qaeda might have been disgraced and destroyed if we had treated them as criminals. C, Americans might have understood who attacked us and why. D, mental illness of the sort publicly exhibited by Karl Rove and his audience might get treated through therapy. Or E, all of the above. I'd say all of the above. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back with your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your wall's too high, I can't see.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, greetings to our friends on WPTT in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we have gone. You've been carrying our program, and we much appreciate it. It had been tape delayed into the early evening, and now we're running live in this time slot on WPTT. This week, Lynn Cullen's on vacation, and next week we'll be staking out this time slot, and Lynn is still, you know, back on the air. So anyway, just very, very happy to be live on WPTT as well in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Kevin in Buford, Georgia on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You covered a lot of ground since you were talking about the reporters.
Yeah.
I hate to get back to that.
That's quite all right. That's quite all right. It's a hot topic. It's a topic that's not going to go away.
My problem with this whole thing is I agree with you on the basic premise that the press shouldn't be forced to reveal their sources. However, on the other hand, when they're being used by the administration simply to hurt someone to a political payback, they shouldn't owe their source anything at that point, you know? And that's what it's kind of like, well, you're standing up for principle. And the woman, I forget her name, reporter.
Judith Miller.
Was carrying the water for the administration for months before the war.
Oh, she was, yeah. She was putting Chalabi's stuff right on the front page of the New York Times.
So,
yeah, but see, here's the point.
So I understand the point is what I'm saying, but the broader point, the reason I have no sympathy, I agree with your point, but I have no sympathy because she carried water for the administration. Now she's protecting somebody in the administration, and it's all because, well, I have this big point. No, it's, you know what it is? It's that you really are just a hack for the administration. And in that case, I really don't care. Yeah. I don't care if you
the
you
I'm a, the you I assume
years.
You're talking about is the reporter, not me.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
No, that's ridiculous.
So, Kevin, here's my point is that and this is a subtle one, and perhaps we've all missed it. If a reporter is given information, the reporter can either choose to use that information or not to use that information. And these reporters had the ability, Judith Miller and Matt Cooper, have the ability right now to write a story saying, here's what's going on in the administration, perhaps even without naming their source. I mean, they had this information. But it is more important in my mind to protect even somebody who's a hack for the administration, even a reporter for the Washington Times, owned by Reverend Moon and totally beholden to the Bush administration, which is in bed with, you know, with the Mooney Church. It's even them. I am so committed to the idea of a free press and to our constitutional protection of a free press. I just think that that's more important than nailing one particular criminal in one particular crime.
And, like I said, I completely agree with you. But these particular, this, well, Judith Miller, the gentleman, I'm not too sure about what his
yeah Matt Cooper
history was.
Yeah.
But I just have no sympathy for her. I'm sorry. I agree with the point. That's what I'm trying to tell you is I get the subtle point,
yeah.
And I agree with it.
But see, that's
the
thing.
At the same time, as she's rotting in jail, it's kind of like, well, good.
We should take her. We should take Judith Miller to task for promoting Ahmed Chalabi's lies and nonsense. I mean, let's deal with each issue on its own merits. Judith Miller, harmed this country greatly, in my opinion, by printing Ahmed Chalabi's lies without ever vetting them, and by being so in love with the fact that somebody in the administration was willing to talk to her, and she was so important that she would publish their stuff, not realizing or perhaps even openly realizing that she was being a propagandist for them. And I, like you, I have little sympathy for her in that regard. No sympathy for her in that regard. But that has nothing to do with whether or not a reporter. See, that's where we have to separate the person and the crime from the thing. And this is what from the principle. Reporters have to have confidential sources or you're not going to have a free press in America.
I agree with you 100%. But it's kind of like the sort of thing where I watched the whole O.J. trial, and at the end I thought he was guilty, but I understood why they couldn't convict him. I mean,
yeah, well, I never understood why they couldn't convict him, but that's a whole different thing. I've got to wrap it up here, Kevin. We got to move along because we're out of time. But I appreciate your call. I understand your point, and we must hold to the principle. We just must hold to the principles. Thanks for the call. It's Tom Hartman with you. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's never too late to start all over again.
Well, let's hope not. Welcome back, my friends. This is Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. It's 27 minutes before the hour. I am seeing this absolute creeping incrementalism. I remember back during the Warren Court, back in the 1960s, the conservatives were all hysterical about the fact that the court was giving human rights to people. The Miranda decision. Oh my God, they're going to let the criminals out of jail there because they weren't properly informed of their rights. What? They should be informed of their rights. They should know their rights. What? We have no obligation to tell them. They should have learned that. They should have been paying attention in third grade. And on it went, right? What? Segregation? What? The Supreme Court is going to allow abortion? The Supreme Court? And on, the conservatives were absolutely hysterical about the the creeping incrementalism of what George Washington referred to when he said, I hope to ever see America in the forefront of liberality in the United States. I hope to always call this a liberal nation. George Washington. And the conservatives were just absolutely hysterical through the 60s. And now they've got power. Now they've got control. Now they've got control of the Supreme Court. Yes, they say there's some liberals on the court. I don't know of any. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a moderate, in my opinion. All the rest of them are conservatives, as far as I can tell. And in fact, in the eminent domain case, 3 out of the 5 who voted in favor of it were appointed by Republican presidents. So now we have it sure looks to me like creeping incremental conservatism. We're rolling back those human right protections. And now journalists can go to jail. And cities can take away your property on behalf of big corporations, and on it goes. So let's get Greg Gorman on here from the Talk Radio News Service. He's actually been at the Supreme Court today. And, Greg, hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. It's been quite, I'll say it's been quite a morning at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so what tell us the story from your end.
Well, obviously, the certiorari case that I heard you talking about earlier with the two journalists, the court did not want to get involved. So that's over now.
Right, but by not getting involved, they got involved. Because by not getting involved,
exactly.
they ratified the decision of the previous judge and in saying that these guys can go to jail. Judith Miller and Matt Cooper can go to jail if they refuse to tell who told them that Valerie Plame, who is the traitor in the White House.
And I believe what you said earlier is right on, and you had me worried for a minute. I thought you were going to say something else when you finally did say that it's right. All journalists should have the ability to keep their sources private or else they can't do what they do. Now, what they write after they either get a source or confirm a source, that's something totally different.
Right.
They should always be allowed to write what they can based on private sources.
Right, and we the people can sit around and complain and yell and scream and jump up and down and try to get them fired or try and get them praised and promoted or whatever. I mean, do the things that we do. But journalists have to have that First Amendment right. I mean, the First Amendment, Congress
That's
shall make no laws.
Yeah,
shall make no laws abridging the freedom of the press, and looks like they have.
Right, and so then the other there are three major cases today. Grokster case, which is on file sharing, and then two, of course, now being called historic Ten Commandments case. I think the history part of these cases is that they went different ways. Some people are finding it hard to believe. I actually believe that the court did exactly what it was expected to do on both of these cases.
Yeah.
I think there's a fine line that the court drew between the Kentucky case and the Texas case, one being a sole monument hanging on a wall inside a courthouse that the court said has had no other purpose except to promote religion, and the monument on the grounds of the Texas State Capitol in Austin, which was part of what was called the walking path of monuments that actually had non-religious a non-religious connotation.
Right. It was.
And that's how they drew the line.
Yeah, and I actually agree with both of those decisions. What I've read of them, it seems like a very reasonable thing. And the great thing about this, by the way, is that the court, much to Scalia's upset, I mean, in his dissent.
Oh, he was angry, Tom. He was angry. He went on.
He read
his entire decision. In fact, we were all listening to the audio, and everybody started looking at each other thinking, what is he going to read his entire
dissent
because he's so angry? And sure enough, he pretty much did. I mean, he was very, very angry.
Yeah, he was very angry because Scalia believes, number one, that the country was founded by religious zealots, which is not the case.
Which is not the case.
And number two, that it should be run by religious zealots. And in fact, Scalia also believes that that the Constitution and laws, that we get our rights from laws. He made the famous case when he came up to Vermont a couple of months ago. He was speaking at the Vermont Law School, and he was talking about abortion. And he said, there's no right to abortion in the Constitution. And if you want a right, you have to pass a law. And I'm sorry, the Constitution does not give us rights. The Constitution says we have all the rights, except for a few things that we agree we're going to take away from ourselves because it's for the greater good of society.
That's right.
And so
what I believe. That's not what Justice Scalia believes.
Yeah, no, Scalia and Thomas, I mean, these guys are in outer space, and that's the scary thing. But
Tom, let me tell you a great anecdote from this morning. Justice Scalia, in his dissent, said that on 9/11, of course, he went right back to 9/11. On 9/11, he said that he was in Rome, Italy. And on the night of 9/11, in our country was obviously the next morning in Italy. He was sitting watching television in the company of some other people, obviously, he said. And he saw the president, our president, say at the end of his speech on the night we were attacked, "In God we trust." And Scalia said the next day he was walking through the town and there was someone who came up to him, knew who he was, and said with tears in his eyes, "I wish that the leader of our country could," I think he said "could talk about," but I don't recall, "could talk about God,"
mm-hmm,
"when he's on television."
Yeah.
And that's how he started his dissent on this case. So
Scalia,
you know,
is,
that tells you what he feels.
Yeah, Scalia is a member of Opus Dei. Scalia is an extreme. He's a member of an extremist cult within Catholicism, and he wants to impose the views of that extremist cult within Catholicism on the United States, and he makes no bones about it.
He makes no bones about it. Exactly. So back to the case is what you said. You know, there is a line drawn between, in Kentucky, this county is not allowed to have a framed copy of the commandments, standing by itself. There's no other value except religion. Whereas in Texas, it's part of this, you know, path that I mentioned.
Right.
You know, there are other monuments. You know, there are war monuments, and there's a legal code. And of course, what everyone else is talking about, in the majority opinion, they reference the frieze inside the courtroom that has Moses holding the tablets with the Ten Commandments written on them.
Right.
And, of course, that is part of a larger, you know...
It's decorative. The bottom line is...
It's decorative, and it's supposed to reveal the history of law in our country.
Right.
It's Moses. There are 19 other figures, all relative figures in the history of law.
Right, exactly. And
that's what Texas, you know, was trying to do on the grounds. Of course, it's pointed out one is inside the courtroom, one is outside of the Capitol, and there's another line of distinction.
Yeah, but although that's not the big line of distinction.
No, exactly.
Because,
that's just another
you know,
one.
You've got the Ten Commandments on the wall in the Supreme Court building, which the right-wingers love to point out. What they don't point out is that it's in the context of a whole great big huge mural of all these other things.
Exactly.
And it's not a promotion of religion.
It's not a promotion of religion, which is what it was.
Now, what about the Grokster case?
Now, Grokster was interesting because it was a completely
file-sharing case.
Right. File-sharing, 9-0, saying that Grokster is a company that created the software that, you know, we all know as file sharing, you know, the Napster case and all those kinds of things. And what the court said is that because the software was created for one thing and one thing only, file sharing, in other words, stealing files, you are not allowed to steal files. Therefore, not only are you under copyright infringement, but the makers of the software that you use will be under copyright infringement as well. And this was a case brought by MGM, the movie studio, saying that people are going online and they're stealing our movies and then they're selling them. And the court said, you know, no, you cannot do that. We uphold that. And we say that if you've created the software that's got one purpose, then we'll help them.
What's this going to do to Usenet?
Well, you know, this is an interesting ruling because, like I've said many times before, sometimes these rulings don't affect people on a wide basis, even though people think that they do. This ruling is going to affect people on a wide basis. You know, if there are companies like Grokster, like Usenet, I mean, all these people who encourage infringement. In other words, you know.
But, I mean, Usenet is part of the original. It kind of preceded the Internet, actually. The Usenet, I don't know if you call them bulletin boards or message boards or whatever, you know, the individual areas where people go in and post messages and have conversations. And there's a lot of them now that are devoted to binary files, to music, to movies, you know, the ones that get the most attention are the pornography ones, I suppose, or the stolen music ones. But they're there. But there's also a lot of legitimate conversations going on. And, you know, there's an attention deficit area in Usenet, you know.
And that's something that they... You know, the court actually made another distinction. There was a previous ruling against the Sony Corporation when someone sued Sony when they created the VCR, saying that, look, a VCR was created so people could steal shows on television. And
right,
the court
said, there
are other uses for a VCR.
Right, and there's a fair use doctrine. The fair use doctrine says that you can make a copy of anything for your own personal use.
Or your own good, or say you're not at home at 9 o'clock and you want to record a show to watch later in your own home, which you won't sell to anyone else, that's fine.
That's legal,
Right, and that's what the court said. This, however, because it's software with one purpose and one purpose only, which is file sharing of stolen files, that's not illegal.
Yeah.
I believe Usenet, if it does have other uses, if a case were to be brought against Usenet, it could probably be argued that, look, there are other uses for this.
Yeah.
It's still illegal if the person is swapping files, but you can't hold Usenet responsible because they have other uses.
So then they go after the individuals who are posting the files, as I think that they already are.
Which is what they do now. And,
yeah.
And what the court said, you know, just because we're holding Grokster responsible doesn't mean we're not holding the users responsible. It's still infringement if I steal a file. However, now it's also infringement of the company because they told me that I could use their software.
Okay, great. Anything else come out of the court today, Greg?
Well, no. Those are the big three. There were a few other smaller cases. And, of course, we're all waiting on the retirement announcement. It did not come from the bench. And Justice Rehnquist actually gaveled the session close. He said, it closed until October. If there is an announcement, it might come tomorrow. It might not come at all. Everyone's waiting to see.
Interesting. Okay, Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Greg, for the report today.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to be with you, too, Greg. Thanks a lot for calling. I do appreciate it. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Be on the program. Jack in Akron, Ohio, on the line. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, you talked about several Supreme Court decisions, and I agree with your analysis of all of them, except the reporter's appeal.
Okay.
I believe you've mischaracterized the question. This is not a question of reporters being required to report something. It is a question of reporters being required to respond to a subpoena and answer questions, just like everyone else.
I agree. I understand.
Okay. And compulsory process, that is, subpoenas, is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. Now, Congress has legislated for
Hang on just a second. A compulsory process is not a right. It is an obligation. It's the opposite of a right.
Well, if you look...
The right to ignore a subpoena was taken away from us by the Constitution, and that's something that we all agreed was a good thing for the better, greater good of all of us. The Constitution doesn't confer rights.
Well, in the Bill of Rights, and I believe it's either the Sixth or the Eighth Amendment, the right of compulsory process is granted to all parties in legal proceedings. It's in there. I don't have my copy of the Bill of Rights handy.
Yeah, well, I do, and yeah, here it is. It's in the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and fair trial, an impartial jury, blah, de, blah, which district, blah, de, blah, to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
Okay. Now, my point is Congress has legislated four privileges, that is, four exceptions, the privilege of counsel, of physicians, of clergy, and spouses. And even those privileges are not absolute. They're limited. For instance, if your wife watches you hit somebody over the head with a baseball bat, she can be compelled to testify against you. If you tell her you hit somebody over the baseball bat, she can't be compelled to testify about that.
Okay. Now, we have 49 states that have passed laws that have said that a reporter cannot be compelled to give his sources. Is there a federal law that says... Are you an attorney, by the way?
No, I'm actually a retired federal agent.
Okay. So, I didn't realize there were these four specific exemptions. I had thought that there was always one for an exemption for journalists. There is not?
Not in the federal system.
Not in the federal code. But there are in 49 states, 49 out of 50 states.
Actually, I think it's more like 38 states have reported shield rights.
The New York Times today reported 49 out of 50.
Okay, maybe it's gone up since I studied the issue.
Yeah.
But simply stated, reporters do not have any privileges. And they're not being denied a right, by the way. Congress has simply chosen not to single them out for this privilege. Like you said about political groups... being denied tax exemptions. It's not a punishment. It's simply a choice not to grant them a privilege. Now, just because the right to a free press is guaranteed does not mean that we need to grant reporters some sort of special privilege or exemption from the law. We don't grant them the right to speed just because it would help them get a story. And there's no reason... Or there might be a reason, but Congress has simply chosen not to grant them the right to confidentiality.
Interesting. Well, Jack, thanks for the detail on that. Then, in that case, if everything you're saying is correct, and it seems that it probably is, then my position on this would be that we at the federal level should do what 49 out of the 50 states have done at the state level, which is to say we're going to add a fifth exemption to that list of four that you named, and say that. That reporters have the right to keep their sources confidential.
Can I add one?
And by the way, I mean, the fact that that is not in law is, I mean, it was torturing Richard Nixon. He wanted to go after Woodward and Bernstein, and he was told he couldn't.
Well, because there was no compelling interest in the court in issuing a subpoena. Can I add one thing?
Yeah, we got about 5 seconds.
As an agent, I had confidential sources, and I had to tell them, if the judge tells me to give up your name, I got to give up your name.
Yeah, okay. All righty, Jack, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate the information and the good solid stuff there. It's the Tom Hartman program, 10 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Cole in Little Rock, Arkansas on the line. Hey, Cole, what's up?
Hi. I want to disagree with you on the Judith Miller case. I think one of the basic guidelines of journalism is to serve the public interest. And I think most of the courts, at least in recent history, have...
Well, hey, let me back up a little bit, Cole. What does serve the public interest mean?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a really broad term, and it maybe is hard to define. But
wouldn't it be better to say that the core purpose of journalism is to tell the truth?
That could be. And that's one thing that the left is continually complaining about right now, is that, you know, journalists aren't doing that.
Sure. People on the right complain about that as well, by the way.
Right. And I just think that courts have sort of got it right in the past, trying to decide whether or not the source that they're trying to protect, if the information is to serve the public interest.
Yeah.
And there really isn't any basis to say that this information that she's, you know, protecting, or the source they're protecting, had any information that served the public interest.
No, but you're talking about this specific case. If that became law, then every reporter, when they're given a piece of information, would have to say, okay, now, if I keep this confidential, this source, will that, by keeping that confidential, will I be serving the public interest or not? And they may have no idea where it's going to lead. They may have no idea the ramifications. I suspect when Woodward and Bernstein first met with Mark Felt with Deep Throat, they had no idea where it was going to go. Or if they did, they didn't think it was going to be as big as it was. So it's, you know, then you're putting reporters in the situation where they have to do a case by case analysis of a situation. I don't think that'll work. I really appreciate, though, Jack's point, who just called a second ago, who pointed out in the Sixth Amendment, it says everybody has the right to call witnesses on their behalf, right? They can, in other words, you can subpoena witnesses. And I'm not sure if Judith Miller and Matt Cooper are being called on behalf of a witness, or if they're being called on behalf of the government. If it's on behalf of the government, then the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply, first of all. But secondly, you know, his point is that there is not a constitutional carve-out for journalists, and I think that there should be a law carve out. I mean, if 49 states have passed that law, the federal government should pass that law. And so I'm sort of changing my position to say, okay, maybe the Supreme Court ruled in a way that was consistent with the Constitution, but it's still, you know, and therefore I would be arguing that the Supreme Court should be making law, and by and large I don't think that the Supreme Court should be making law. I'm not, you know, in favor of an activist court. And so, therefore, I think the legislators should be making law. So I'm going to shift the focus of my argument on this one. Cole, thanks for the call. These are important discussions to have, and you raise a good point. It's just, I don't think the reporters should ever be in the position of having to say, okay, I just learned something. Do I call the police or not? Or do I call, you know, the newspaper or not? Or do I call the federal prosecutor or not? I just don't think that should be the case. It's Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Call calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Indeed. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Toll free across the United States. From outside the United States, 1-503-248-0620. The website, TomHartman.com. Going to drop into the live chat room and participate in online, live, real-time conversations with some of the finest minds in the entire internet. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat and click our message board, and you can participate in conversations there. Some 50, 60,000 messages have been posted, and lots of fascinating ongoing discussions and very often links to resources that you didn't even know were there. I learn a lot from reading my own message board. Today, the Food and Drug Administration, or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, rather, has announced that a cow with mad cow disease has been found. They're not even able to identify exactly which cow it was now, because the cow's been so long, and the cow is such a wreck, and it's just pieces of the cow, and this, that, and the other thing. And the Agriculture Department had stalled on this thing for months. Apparently since November. So, yes, there is mad cow disease in the United States, and yes, it's out there. And at the same time, the administration, of course, Ann Veneman was one of the leaders of the Cattlemen's Association. And now here, this article from, I think this is an Associated Press story. It was on commondreams.org. American cattle are eating chicken litter, cattle blood, and restaurant leftovers that could help transmit mad cow disease, a gap in the U.S. defense that the Bush administration promised to close nearly 18 months ago. John Stauber, an activist and co-author of Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here, who's been on this program, by the way. John Stauber said, once the cameras were turned off and the media coverage dissipated, then it's been business as usual. No real reform. Just keep feeding slaughterhouse waste. This is a way of saving money, basically, is the bottom line for the factory food industry, the factory farm industry. He says the entire U.S. policy is designed to protect livestock industry's access to slaughterhouse waste as cheap feed. See, it's all about money. Loopholes include ground-up cattle remains can be fed to chicken, and then chicken litter, chicken poop, is fed back to the cattle. Poultry feed that spills from chicken cages mixes with chicken waste on the ground and then is swept up for use in cattle feed. Scientists believe the BSE protein will survive the feed-making process and may survive being digested in chickens. Cattle blood can be fed to cattle and often comes in the form of milk replacement for calves. Some scientists believe blood from infected cattle could transmit the disease. Restaurant leftovers are called plate waste. They're allowed in cattle feed. And, of course, very often that's pieces of cow, right? Some beef. Cuts of meat that contain part of the spinal cord or become contaminated by spinal tissue while being prepared could be infected with BSE. Factories are not required to use separate production lines and equipment for feed that contains cattle remains and feed that does not, creating the risk that cattle remains could accidentally go into cattle feed. And besides being fed to poultry, cattle protein is allowed in feed for pigs and household pets, creating the possibility it could be mistakenly fed to cattle. And unfiltered tallow or fat is allowed in cattle feed, and yet it has protein impurities that could be a source of mad cow disease. And to those who want to get really nervous, I would add that there are some concerns about gelatin. Gelatin is made from cattle, by and large. And could it be that gelatin capsules? You taking your vitamins, your herbs, are they in gelatin capsules? Should you be concerned about that? We don't know. At least I don't know. On Friday, I don't want to make an absolute blanket statement here, but from everything I've been able to find out, there's a lot of uncertainty about these things. But on Friday, the Department of Agriculture announced a confirmed case of mad cow disease in the United States. Back in November, they could have known this, but the Bush administration refused to perform the necessary tests. Finally, their inspector general, Phyllis Fong, ordered the test this month, and when it was finally conducted, sure enough, mad cow disease in the United States. I would like to see them start doing autopsies on people who have been diagnosed, who have died of and been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, because I have this creepy suspicion that there's an awful lot of Alzheimer's cases that are not really Alzheimer's. I have a feeling we've had mad cow disease in this country for a long time, and we're just doing everything we can to cover it up. Why? Because it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. I mean, it's very simple. Here's another piece. This from GorillaNews.com. Big food strikes back. Legislation to prevent counties, towns, and cities from making local decisions about our food supplies are being introduced in states across the nation. Now, understand this. All across the country, in legislatures, there are laws being introduced that make it illegal for a local community to either make decisions about the food that's being served in that community or to inform people about it. 15 states have recently introduced legislation removing local control of plants and seeds. 11 of these states have already passed the provisions into law. These highly orchestrated industry actions are in response to recent local decisions to safeguard sustainable food systems. To date, initiatives in three California counties have restricted the cultivation of genetically modified crops, livestock, and other organisms, and nearly 100 New England towns have passed various resolutions in support of limits on genetically engineered crops. These laws are industry's stealth response. These laws to prevent local communities from doing this are industry's stealth response to a growing effort by people all across the United States who want to protect their communities at the local level. And this, you know, you combine this with the Supreme Court stuff and the Guantanamo Bay stuff, and Jose Padilla is still in prison. And what is he charged with? Nothing. Has he seen his lawyer? No, as far as we can tell. Has he been able to call home? No. The only evidence the administration has released about him is that he was looking on the Internet at sites about how to build a dirty bomb. 2.5 years now this guy's been in jail. The time from 9/11 to today is greater than the time from Pearl Harbor to the end of World War II, and Bush says he knows how to prosecute a war. Say what? I'm telling you, some very fundamental issues, some very fundamental problems are not being addressed in this country, like protecting we the people. Instead, multinational corporations are being protected. Yes, they can have all the illegal immigrant labor they want. Yes, they can have all the so-called free trade that they want. We'll tear down those barriers. We'll tear down those tariffs that protect domestic industry and protect domestic jobs. And sure, they make everything that they want. Make it in China and bring it over here. And now China's taking all the money from that. All that stuff that you bought at Walmart, China's taking all the money from that and going, hey, Let's buy some American oil companies. Let's buy Maytag. Let's buy Unocal. Yeah, maybe if we get Unocal, we'll even get Hamid Karzai, who used to work for Unocal. He's the president of Afghanistan now. This was back when Unocal, who's roughly 70% of their holdings are Asian gas holdings, as in natural gas, and Hamid Karzai was working to build a gas pipeline across Afghanistan. And guess what, folks? On that pipeline route right now, we are building three military bases with your tax dollars and mine in Afghanistan. And Unocal's man is the president of Afghanistan, so China says, hey, let's buy Unocal. Chevron's willing to buy him for $17 billion. We'll offer $18.5 billion. Strange times. The consequence of insane conservative economic policies. George Bush has spent us into poverty. We have become one of the poorest nations in the world in terms of one of the most indebted nations in the world. I guess that's worse than poverty. It was called Starve the Beast. They started it under Reagan. This was the theory of the Grover Norquist types. Let's just starve the beast. Let's make the government so broke that those do-gooder liberals can no longer have their do-gooder programs like unemployment insurance and Social Security and the social safety net that catches people who fall through the cracks. Let's just see to it that they can no longer afford to do that. And we'll start out by starving the beast, the beast being the government, by cutting back taxes on the multimillionaires and billionaires. And that'll encourage the millionaires and billionaires to build factories in China. And they did. And it's just incredible to me that they were actually able to sell this thing, and people bought it. People bought it. I mean, George Bush saying, I mean, can you imagine a president of the United States coming out and saying, let's spend $500,000 per job to create jobs that pay $15,000, $20,000 a year, $30,000, maybe $40,000 a year. What, the median income in the United States, $32,000 a year. Let's pay $500,000 to some rich guy. I mean, and, you know, people making 100 grand think they're rich. Sorry, I'm talking about people who are making a billion. You know, let's pay $500,000 to some multimillionaire so that he'll create one job that pays $32,000, one median income job. If he had said that, people would say, what, are you nuts? Well, that's what he said. And the press didn't pick up on it. Here he is.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Now, if you divide 1 million into $550 billion, what do you get? $500,000 per job. Where was the media? They were totally sound asleep. I mean, this is outrageous. And my point, to bring all this stuff together, it sounds like, you know, I've gone off on all these different tangents. This is all the same thing. Big food running the country, telling the administration what to do, passing laws in the states that protects itself, the Bush administration looking out for the interests of corporate wealth and inherited wealth, the middle class vanishing, the loss of liberties so that if the middle class ever says, hey, wait a minute, we want to have a union, we're going to stand up. And Ronald Reagan taught us that, no, you can slap them down. Ever since he declared war on organized labor. The ability now that they have to say, you know, when the leaders show up, if you're not one of the syncopants of the leader, you can't show up. If you've got a no blood for oil sticker on your car, bumper sticker on your car, no matter how nice and polite and well-mannered you are, we're going to drag you off and put you in the free speech zone a half mile down the road with a barbed wire fence around it. It's all the same stuff, my friends. It's the takeover of the cons. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Heard newborn babies wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers, and now porn stars as well. Mary Carey there showing up with George Bush, and Keith Olbermann asking her what makes her sure that she's a Republican. She says, what, her and all the other, she said that, you know, we all screw people for money. It's, this. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Eaton Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
What's up with you? Hey, I used to be a reporter.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell your listeners that you can't be an effective newspaper reporter unless you have confidential sources and you keep them confidential.
Yeah, I was a reporter for 7 years in Michigan, and although I was doing radio, but still, for the first four of those years, part of my beat was to go down and talk to the mayor and do the police blotter and go over to the state capitol and talk to in Lansing and talk to the various legislators. And in fact, there was one particular, well, I don't need to get into the whole details, but yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah, I worked in for a daily paper in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I covered all those small towns up and down the Connecticut River Valley.
Yep, yep.
And I had confidential sources, in the little small town governments, and people would call me, and you got to be able to keep your sources secret and confidential. And I think a different Supreme Court could have, in spite of what your caller Jack said, and I suppose he's got a technical argument there, but I think a different court could have decided that this is a freedom of press issue.
Yeah, I think, for example, the Warren Court probably would have. Well, it was a 5-4 decision. So, it's pretty clear that but for one vote, it would have gone the other way. So this is not something that is black and white and clearly defined. Now, what would make it black and white and clearly defined is if the federal government were to pass a law, a federal shield law, for reporters. And
that's what we need.
Yeah, I agree. I really think we need that. And so I encourage people to contact their elected representatives. You can call your both of your senators and your Congress, your member of Congress, at toll free 1-877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U, SOB, 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the toll free number for Congress. And it really is. It's not a joke. It's the old Senate office building number. And you call that number and ask for your elected member of, if you're not sure who your congressman is, give them, or congresswoman, as the case may be, give them your zip code and they'll tell you. And they'll connect you to the office. And your senator, of course, each state has two senators, and you're represented by both of them. And say, hey, given this Supreme Court decision, why don't you introduce legislation to shield reporters? Because we would like to see more freedom of the press in the United States, not less. And we're on a trajectory right now where the press is becoming nothing more than a parrot for the administration. It's becoming the official propaganda arm of the Bush administration and nothing else. And it just ain't a good thing.
Hey, Tom, I got a question for you about the case, the Valerie Plame investigation.
Yeah.
Why are they issuing subpoenas to reporters in the first place? I mean, I think that they do that for a reason. I'm not quite sure what it is, but if they really wanted to investigate this case, why don't they start hauling members of the Bush administration in front of the grand jury?
Well, it's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it.
I really think they should. I heard a retired intelligence officer on the radio talking, and he said there's only about 6 people in the White House who have the power and the authority to be able to get the name and the identification of a CIA agent.
Yeah.
And so that's not the kind of information just anybody can get.
But George Bush would defer with you, Mike. George said...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So there you go.
We know what that's, oats and grain.
There you go. There you go. Thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Yeah, why are they threatening to throw Judith Miller and Matt Cooper in jail when instead they could be talking to Scooter Libby and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and saying, hey, you guys, fess up. Well, the reason is obvious. It's the same reason that they won't release the documents about John Bolton. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Is you glad you got nothing to feel? Is you glad that it's all so real? Hey, babe, somebody shine on me.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by revitalizing and returning democracy to the United States of America. Frank Rich wrote a piece in the New York Times over the weekend about the whole situation with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which I understand they're thinking of renaming the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting. And if they have their way, and he pointed out that there was this big hoop-de-doop done, last week or the week before about the Republicans are trying to kill Big Bird. They're trying to cut back on the funding for the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting and all that kind of thing. And Frank Rich essentially was suggesting this is just window dressing. You know, this is the classic magic trick. You know, in stage magic, a stage magician, he will make sure that if he's going to do something with his left hand that is actually making the trick work, you know, he's going to, you know, flip the card or move the ring or whatever it is, then with his right hand, with his other hand, he's going to be doing something very, very flashy, swinging the scarf around or whatever, so that you will notice that. You know, in other words, here it's going on over here, so don't look over there. Or so do look over. It's going on here, so look over there. And that the real agenda of these guys is not to destroy public broadcasting, because they don't think that they can do that. And in fact, I don't think they could do it either. The real agenda is not to destroy public broadcasting. It's to take it over. And perhaps even strengthen it once they've taken it over, to turn public broadcasting into the propaganda arm of the Bush administration. These guys are, and this is the thing that scares me the most about the Bush administration, or concerns me the most, let's say, is that they are behaving as if they know that they will always be in power. Let's do away with a 200-year-old constitutional, or 200-year-old Senate rule, the filibuster. Why would you do that if the Democrats might come back into power? They could use that against you. Well, they believe they're always going to have power. But what about elections? Well, could it have something to do with Republican-controlled corporations owning the voting machines? As one of many conspiracy theories? I mean, why this, and for that matter, I mean, here's the other thing that concerns me. Is Bush clearly lied us into this war for political purposes? I mean, there's no doubting that now. The evidence is all there. The Downing Street, even before the Downing Street memos, the evidence was there. All you had to do is read Bob Woodward's book, for that matter, and read Paul O'Neill's book, and Richard Clark's book, and it's there. We got into the war with Iraq, pure and simple, so that the Republicans could take the Senate in 2002, and that Bush could win the presidency in 2004. Period. End of discussion. But there was oil there. Yes, of course there was oil there. And that was a wonderful benefit. But Bush didn't like his father. He hates his father. And he wanted to show that he was more of a man than it. Yes, of course, that was a benefit. But there's a grudge between the Bushes and Bin Laden. Yes, of course, and that was a benefit. All those things were benefits. But it was all about political power. And the thing that concerns me is that these folks, these so-called conservatives, I'm starting to say so-called Republicans, because they are not Republicans like Dwight Eisenhower was, that it increasingly looks to me like they will do anything to retain power. We learned during the Reagan years that they would slash taxes on the extremely wealthy and increase taxes on average working people more than any tax increase in the history of the United States, in the 200 and some odd year history of the United States. Ronald Reagan increased taxes. And who did he increase taxes on? People who earn $30,000 a year or less. How? By increasing the Social Security tax. And did that money go into the Social Security Trust Fund? No, it was used in the general account, which then issued IOUs to the Social Security Trust Fund. The only way, Reagan did it, the starve the beast thing, and threw this country into debt, into trillions of dollars of debt. We're going to spend $160 billion just this year in interest on just that part of the debt that Reagan ran up to make things look good so he could get himself reelected in 1984. So how did he sustain that kind of debt? He did it by raising the Social Security taxes in 1982 and then borrowing that money into the general fund. And that's why there's no money in the Social Security Trust Fund. There's just a whole bunch of IOUs, as George Bush correctly pointed out. And if we had to pay that back, those IOUs, well, we don't have the ability. We don't have the means. You'd have to have a massive tax increase. So these guys, they have been willing to throw us into debt to achieve and hold power. They've been willing to lie us into a war to achieve and hold power. They've been willing to bring down a CIA operation in order to achieve and hold power. They're willing to lock people up essentially for life with no access to due process, throw the Constitution out the window, no access to lawyers, no access to family and friends, American citizens just to hold and retain power. And they're not going to let them out, because if they let them out, then they would have to admit that they were wrong and they might lose some of that power. Remember, George Bush told his official biographer, one of the things that a leader does is he never admits he's wrong. Then you lose power. And he really believes that. You know, I want the Republican Party to go back to its Republican. Please, take back the Republican Party. Let's go back to Dwight Eisenhower. When speaking about suggestions that we should have a borrow and spend kind of economy like the Republicans do now. Keep in mind, the top marginal tax rate when Dwight Eisenhower was president was 95%. If you were making $10, $20, $30 million a year, 95% tax on the top end of that. And Eisenhower said, no, we're not going to lower those taxes because we have to have a progressive society. We have to pay the bills of government. And if we don't pay the bills of government, we're going to leave our children with a disaster. Here's Dwight Eisenhower.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow.
Which is exactly what these guys have done. It's exactly what Reagan did. And then he jacked up the social security tax sky high, just about doubled it, and started using that money in the general fund so he could pretend that the tax cut that he introduced didn't make any difference. And that's why Dick Cheney, not understanding that, he's not a bright bulb when it comes to economics, or he's willing to lie to us. Dick Cheney said, famously, oh, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. I'm sorry, Reagan taught us that deficits do matter. You've got to raise taxes in some other way, like with Social Security, in order to cover those deficits, or you're going to have problems. Eisenhower continued.
We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
And that's where we're at right now. Democracy is becoming the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. Thanks to these folks who call themselves Republicans, call themselves conservatives in the White House and in Congress. And frankly, I don't see them as Republicans or conservatives. I mean, that was a Republican you were just listening to. What has happened to that party? All this stuff in the name of power. And what concerns me is if they're willing to do all these things, if they're willing to lie us into a war that has led to the death of over 1,700 Americans and the dismemberment of over 20,000 Americans and the death of as many as 100,000 Iraqis, if they're willing to do that, if they're willing to destroy evidence in the anthrax investigation, for what reason? I don't know. You tell me. Why did the Bush administration destroy evidence in the anthrax investigation? If they're willing to stonewall the 9/11 investigation, if they're willing to refuse to release information on John Bolton and what he was up to with regard to 9/11, then might we have some legitimate concern that something that we really don't expect would happen may happen just before the 2006 elections? That's my concern, I got to say. And I realize that it at one level, it makes me sound like an absolute conspiracy nut. And I'm not saying that I'm not saying these guys are going to attack America or they were behind the anthrax attacks and they're going to do the same thing again. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that I have seen enough evidence that they believe that the ends justify the means. That if that happened, if there was an attack on America, and it came about as the result of the failure to defend this country by the Bush administration, and that failure was intentional, it would not surprise me. I mean, here we know, for example, we know Mohammed Atta, who the guy who masterminded the 9/11 attacks, Mohammed Atta was in the very beginning. He said. You'd have to go back and read the 9/11 Commission report. He said that he was originally thinking of attacking the Indian Point nuclear reactor. This is a nuclear power plant that's, you know, just, what, 40, 50 miles north of New York City? And had he hit that thing with an airplane, then a 100-mile radius around it would be sterile for 10,000 years. New York City would be gone. I mean, you think of 9/11, multiply that by 1,000, by 100,000, by 1,000,000. I flew into Germany the week that, you know, 4 or 5 days after Chernobyl melted down. Just as the radioactive cloud was flying over Frankfurt, was raining over Frankfurt. The streets of Frankfurt were deserted when I got out of the subway from the airport. I'm walking through the rain. I can't figure out, where did everybody go? Everybody was hiding from the radiation. And it turns out the only reason Mohammed Atta chose the World Trade Center instead of the Indian Point nuclear power plant was because he believed that the nuclear power plant, because it could cause such devastation, had to be surrounded by surface-to-air missiles, and he would have been shot down before he had a chance to hit it. He believed that. And now we know, and this is not, you know, I'm not telling this to the terrorists here on this broadcast or anything. This is stuff that has been in every newspaper in America. It's been in, you know, investigative reports. It's all over the place. Now we know that there are no defenses on any of our nuclear power plants. Well, you say the containment vessels are so powerful, so strong, so, you know, so thick concrete. Even if you hit it with a 747, it wouldn't do anything. Well, that may be the case. But what about the pool next to it? Next to every nuclear power plant in this country, virtually every nuclear power plant in this country, there's more than 100 of them, next to every one of them is a giant swimming pool at the bottom of, filled with water, at the bottom of which is years worth of nuclear waste. There's more radioactivity in that pool than there is in the core in the containment vessel. The hijacker's plane doesn't need to hit the containment vessel. All it needs to do is hit that pool. And it's not protected. It doesn't even have a top over it. The Bush administration could have protected these things. They could have said to the nuclear power industry, you got to put cement covers on these pools to protect them just like you have the containment vessels. No, the nuclear power industry said, it's too expensive. Not only that, we've got this law that says that if any kind of a disaster happens at a nuclear power plant, we don't have to pay for it. The federal government does. We don't even have to buy insurance. The federal government will take care of it. It's this incredibly massive subsidy to the nuclear power industry, so they don't care. So our nuclear power plants are right now unprotected. There's over 100 massive nuclear dirty bombs in the United States just waiting to be attacked. Same thing with our chemical factories. Did Bush go to the chemical industry and say, okay, you've got chemical plants here that could easily be hit by a stolen plane, or even somebody dropping a bomb out of a plane? Or a truck bomb or something. Did he go to them and say, you got to protect these? No. Our ports. They could bring an atomic bomb into our ports. Did he say, we've got to screen our cargo? No. Our aircraft. Did he say, we've got to start screening all the cargo? No. What did they do? They started making us take our shoes off at the airport. Why? Because this administration is more committed to appearance than to reality. If they can create the appearance that they're doing something, that's all it takes. And if we get hit again, I guarantee you they will use it to their advantage. They will say, see, it's all because of the liberals. It's all because of the Democrats. They'll figure out some way to say that, just like they're trying to blame 9/11 on Bill Clinton, even though it happened on Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and George Bush's watch, and they were warned. George Bush, in the months leading up to 9/11, had no fewer than 56 memos specifically talking about the fact that Osama bin Laden was determined to strike within the United States, that they were talking about hijacking aircraft, that they were probably going to crash them into high-profile buildings. In fact, just a few months before that, George Bush himself had been over in Europe at the G8 meeting, and they had to take him out and put him on an aircraft carrier overnight in the ocean because they had credible intelligence that Osama bin Laden was going to hijack an aircraft and crash it into the hotel where he was staying. And then Condi Rice has the audacity to go on national television and say, oh, had we ever imagined that they might hijack? Who could have imagined that they would hijack an airplane and turn it into a missile? Who could have imagined it? When 2 months earlier they'd moved George Bush out to an aircraft carrier to protect him from exactly that, and they knew that it was Osama bin Laden who was going to do it. So I got to say, I'm a little concerned. Another reason why I think it's so important that freedom of the press be upheld and the confidential sources of reporters be absolutely there. Because we need to know more about what's going on in our government 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
For the history books tell it, they tell it so well.
And welcome back, my friends.
The cavalry's charge and the Indians fell. The cavalry's charge and the Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side.
4.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. I thought I'd give you a couple quick updates about my weekend, and then I'd also like to challenge folks to get their talking points in line and get on these local drive-time right-wing shows tonight and knock this whole Ten Commandments thing down, because they will be out there preaching and raising hell about it and how terrible liberals are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to be taking the offensive tonight. Secondly, we had our Democratic County Committee meeting this weekend.
Uh-huh.
A big organizing thing, you know, and here's what we want to get accomplished. We had approximately 110 people there, of which I recognized at least 50 folks being true, solid progressives, the vast majority of whom had never been involved before.
Oh, that's the thing that gives me hope. As much as I am concerned that the Bushies are going to do something, or just by their negligence, some horrible thing is going to happen in this country and it's going to help them politically, as much as I'm concerned about that, the upside of the whole thing that I see is that people are waking up from one end of this country to the other.
We have a progressive as the chairman of the Rules Committee, as the chairman of the Communications Committee, and as the chairman of the Meetings Agenda Committee. And so, you know, all of a sudden, We're taking over powers, positions of influence within the party. And even the old-timers know that they better get off of it and get it shaken up and get active and take this country back. In our county, last state elections, we had 2 senatorial districts go unchallenged to the righties, and we had 3 representative seats go unchallenged. Every seat's going to be challenged.
There you go.
If we get beat, we're going to get beat, but we're not going to give it to them.
There you go. Well said, Roy, and good on you. Congratulations. When I spoke in Michigan, I gave a speech on Saturday, and afterwards a couple came up to me, and I'd guess in their 70s, and they said, we've been Republicans all our lives. We're still Republicans. We're active in the party, and we're taking our party back from these crazies. I was just amazed. I mean, this is an elderly couple. We're taking this party back from the crazies. That was wonderful. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.